If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm not quite here with Bob McGinn, but we are speaking with Bob McGinn. Bob, where are you today?
I am in Saline, Michigan.
And what are you doing there?
Saline, Michigan is a suburb of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I'm over here for tonight and into Saturday for the 125th reunion of the Michigan Daily.
Now, for those of us who don't know, the Michigan Daily is?
The campus newspaper at Michigan. I worked on the sports staff my sophomore, junior, and senior year. That's where I got hooked on this nasty business, Mike. And so I'm going to be seeing guys I've worked with and hung around with. I haven't seen them in 40 years, so that goes on tonight. And then we go to the BYU game on noon Saturday over here.
Did you start your draft series with the Michigan Daily?
No, that waited a few years, Mike.
I know you've been in communication with some of your buddies to figure out who will be going to this and who won't. Who's maybe, are there some guys going that you didn't expect to see and you're excited to get to hang out with?
The sports editor my junior year, and the students, we ran this paper, and it was 6 days a week, Mike. We had a Sunday and everything. We had a massive budget. We competed against the Ann Arbor News and the Detroit papers. We were a little wild and crazy, but let's see, the sports editor of my junior year was John Papanek, who later went on to have a great career at Sports Illustrated and ESPN, the magazine. My roommate was the manager on the football team, the number two manager on Schembechler's football team. He
okay.
Worked at the paper on the side. People from all over the place, you know.
What were your measurables in college? What'd you have for a height and weight back then, Bob?
5'1", 6", 173.
Okay. And did you have any injuries over the course of your career with the Michigan Daily?
Could have. We played a lot of, we played other campus newspapers. We were called the Daily Libels.
You played in touch football or basketball or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, touch football. We had a grand tradition. We wrote about it 3 or 4 days a week in a little box on the sports page about how we would destroy these teams, the Ohio State Lantern and whatnot.
Were you a quarterback, I assume?
I was.
Okay, and did you run the same offense you ran in high school?
No, it was all throw then, Mike.
Okay. When's the last time you went to a game in the Big House?
Last year, Tyler Dunn and I, before the Lion-Packer game, we saw Utah destroy the Maize and Blue under Brady Hoke.
Okay, and are you interested in seeing, I mean, I know you're not going to be in the press box and you won't be around him really, but what are you, you looking forward to seeing Mr. Harbaugh there?
BYU has, you know, knocked off some good teams already.
Sure.
Michigan's a 5-point favorite. Michigan has, a lousy quarterback, a guy who transferred from my son's school at Iowa. My son told me all about Mr. Jake Rudolph. But, you know, Harbaugh's doing what I thought he would. He's running the ball. He's playing D. He's going to try to keep games close. He's going to be physical the way he was with the Niners and Stanford. And so we'll see. I mean, they're not that good, but I think they could, you know, at least threaten Michigan State and Ohio State this year.
Well, it sounds like a fun weekend. So when you make your bleary-eyed drive back to Green Bay on Sunday, we'll know why.
You got it, Mike.
All right, so we've covered your whereabouts. Now let's cover your song choice. Tell everyone what that was and why you went with it this week.
That's a one-hit wonder from fall, winter of 1967, Pushing Too Hard by the Seeds, S-E-E-D-S, kind of an L.A. garage band. Went to number 36 in December of 67. A one-hit wonder. I kind of liked the thing. What'd you think of it, Mike?
I liked it. It had a little spunk to it. It was it was a little cool. I liked it. And, some of those one-hit wonder bands, man, they you start listening to some of their deep cuts, too, and you can find a track or two that's not too bad.
Okay.
All right. So now we've covered that stuff. We'll get to, I guess, what the purpose of this podcast is, other than for you and I to enjoy each other's company. So there was a game last Sunday night. It was a darn good football game, and the Packers knocked off the Seahawks in a rematch of the NFC Championship game. You know, perhaps one of the defining moments of that game was in the second half, in the fourth quarter, when the Packers went to an offensive package that included Randall Cobb and Ty Montgomery on the field at the same time. Now, I know you mentioned that in your film review that you do every week. What stood out to you about that package?
Well, just the versatility of Cobb. You know, we've written about this, Tom and I, you know, last year and even the year before. But it's one of the first times you saw it, you know?
Sure.
Let me get your impressions. I mean, you see number 18 in the backfield. What'd you think?
Well, I guess this is what I wrote my sidebar about during the game. And I just, the whole package itself to me was really fascinating because Montgomery lined up on that possession in the left slot. He lined up in the right slot. And he lined up offset in the backfield. Cobb lined up in the slot. Cobb lined up in the backfield. So you've got these two guys that are more or less totally interchangeable in that package, and when they come out of the backfield, it's just there's so much instant separation because they can't be pushed off the line of scrimmage or pushed within 5 yards by someone. I just wonder, and I mentioned this in my sidebar, you'd know better than me, but I wonder if it foreshadowed maybe a larger use or larger deployment of that package as the season goes along. What do you think?
Well, you know, McCarthy, I think Cobb had like 46 snaps from the backfield last year.
Okay.
You know, there are limitations, you know, in pass protection. I mean, they just can't have Cobb, especially with a bad shoulder, picking up any kind of a blitz.
Right.
It limits their run game, obviously, with Cobb. They don't, again, with the shoulder, they don't want him getting drilled. Mike, when Cobb's healthy, though, they'll hand him the ball on even an inside zone. I mean, the guy's a he ran a lot at Kentucky as a quarterback. He knows how to run in traffic. So if he was healthy, I don't think he'd be afraid of that. So there are some limitations. I see it as a changeup and a very intriguing one.
You think there's any chance they'd give Montgomery the ball on some of those inside handoffs the way they do with Cobb?
Yeah, I do. Don't you? I mean,
I think so too. He bounced off tacklers the other night.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's something they could use. And I guess it, more broadly, maybe not necessarily just in that package, but do you think Montgomery's performance and the way he sort of handled the moment fairly well warrants him maybe a little bit of a longer leash against the Kansas City Chiefs?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I definitely do.
Cool. Well, another area that was obviously very impressive against the Seahawks, and particularly because of the tailback that team has, Marshawn Lynch, was the run defense. And front and center of that was Mr. B.J. Raji, who I know that you were impressed with him when you watched the tape. I was impressed with him when I watched the tape. And McCarthy said it might have been his best game ever as a Green Bay Packer. What did you make of his performance?
Tremendous. I mean, he kicked ass.
Yes, he did.
That's what the game's really about. And, you know, he didn't do that against the Bears, and he did it against the Seahawks. Now, why? The Bears had a veteran center in Mr. Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
But Montgomery is strong, but, I mean, he's not an athletic guy anymore. He's over 30, and he's not a top-tier center by any means.
Sure.
Seahawks were starting Drew Nowak, who's making his second start, the player from DePere, Wisconsin, converted D lineman. So, you know, Nowak has had some problems. He won the job in mid-August. I mean, that's part of it. BJ was too strong and too quick and just overall too good for him. Three tackles for loss, a couple walkbacks. He set up a sack or two. It was an overwhelming performance. I mean, how did you see Raji?
I thought he was tremendous. And one of the things I wondered about, and you'd know better than me because you've been around guys who have come back from season-ending injuries more than I have, but I wondered if the first game was also partly Raji shaking off some rust, getting used to a full game's worth of contact, and then he comes back against the Seahawks and his body is a little bit more used to the pounding that he'd experienced his whole career but didn't get last year because of the injury. Do you think that plays into it at all?
That could be. I go back to the opposition, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, we saw Raji that first 10, 12 days of camp. I mean, he really exploded out of the blocks.
Yes, he did.
There's no question. I mean, he was giving Lindsley a lot of problems in the one-on-one rush and in the inside run game drill. Raji's a key player for him, and he's got to, you know, stay healthy and keep coming through.
I guess what impressed me most about Raji, and it kind of sounds silly because anytime you see him, you know right away that this is an enormous man physically. But I guess what stuck out to me, because we didn't see it so much against the Bears, is that when he breaks through the line of scrimmage and is able to generate pressure and disrupt the play, because of his size, it's amazing to me just how much he can actually disrupt in terms of the amount of space behind the line of scrimmage. So in other words, when he gets past his man or bulges and pushes him back into the backfield, I mean, you're talking about a distance that's about 5 feet across that he can completely nullify given his size and his wingspan. You know what I mean, Bob?
Yeah. He's 6'1" and a half, and he's just wide, isn't he?
He really is.
Yeah, he's 330, and he's low and wide.
So, I mean, they limited Lynch to 41 rushing yards, 2.7 yards per carry, as Dom Capers was quick to point out in his discussion with the media on Monday. But aside from Raji, did you think anyone else along the defensive line upped their level of play from the game against Chicago to contribute to that strong effort?
I thought Daniels was definitely better.
I thought so,
and
too.
I thought Pinnell was clearly better. I think Pinnell's the guy we should talk about next.
Okay.
He's a hard man to block. He doesn't stay blocked, and he's quick. He has really good hand usage for a young guy. That's a little unusual. He gets off blocks. He shoves hands off him from the tackler guard, trying to get those hands inside. And he not only shoves those hands off, he has quick arm usage, and he gets around people and gets tackles.
Did scouts describe him as a good athlete? I've been impressed with his athleticism.
Yes, they did. You know, he only played 5 games of Division I football, and that worried him. There was a lot of character risks. And then he played at Pueblo against the Division II opposition, and, you know, you take that stuff with a grain of salt. But, no, they did like him as an athlete. I was surprised he wasn't drafted.
So now you've got Pinnell, a guy who, you know, has been hit or miss in terms of his consistency, but when he flashes, it's pretty impressive. And now, given the injury to Josh Boyd, who's obviously out for the year with that fractured ankle, I would think that a guy like Pinnell, his importance tends to skyrocket a little bit here. Would you agree?
He was up against Seattle. He was down against the Bears. He had 2 really bad plays in the Bear game.
One, yes, he did.
Destroyed at the point of attack, and the other one, he was just out of position at the point of attack. So, you know, he's 1 for 2. We can't go overboard, but they definitely need him this week without Guion.
Yeah, and then that's one thing I wanted to ask you, too. When Guion comes back, I mean, how do you sort of envision everything shaping up?
Reports back in shape, then, you know, in some form or fashion, you got Guion, Raji, and Daniels would be the starters that we suspect, with Pinnell playing a lot, and then Dayton Jones playing on passing downs. I mean, is that the way you see it?
I think so. I really do. Although I think that from what we've seen, there's going to be a lot of mixing and matching. You know, there's definitely, in both the base defense and the nickel, and even the dime, but to a lesser extent the dime, it's been clear that the coaches have their preferred combinations of sort of their go-to guys, but we've seen tons of mixing and matching so far with, you know, Raji and Daniels playing on one possession in the nickel, and then you've got, we saw Boyd and Daniels on one possession, and there's all kinds of mixing and matching in there. So I think even though the 3 guys that you mentioned, Daniels, Raji, and Guion will probably be the starters, I think that Pinnell will still have a lot of opportunities. And one guy who I was kind of impressed with, again, this was the first time I really got to see him, but I thought Dayton Jones played pretty well in that dime package against the Seahawks. One play in particular where he completely hurdled a guy at the line of scrimmage to tackle Lynch for a 1-yard loss really, really impressed me. But I kind of got the sense that that's sort of the flashes that have been there throughout his career, and then it's just the complete lulls and consistency in between that frustrate people.
Right, Mike. Yeah, there have been flashes. More his second year than the first. There were some injuries both years. But he does some things athletically, and he's a player who's still, his career's at the crossroads, so we'll see. Now they lost Josh Boyd, you know, for the year in that game on his third snap.
Yep.
I guess I'm higher on Boyd than some people. How did you see Boyd, and what do you assess his impact of that loss to be?
I thought Boyd was pretty solid against the run. I liked what I saw from him. He was a guy who I thought took up a lot of space in the same way that Raji did, and I thought he played with a little bit of tenacity to him, on a more tenacity that you saw snap in and snap out, whereas sometimes with guys like Pinnell or Dayton Jones, they sort of vanish for a couple snaps and then they pop up again. But I thought Boyd sort of played with the tenaciousness, the tenacity that you see from a guy like Daniels, who even when he's not making plays, there's no questioning his motor. And I sort of thought that about Boyd.
I agree 100%. Boyd is Boyd's a battler, and he has some quick twitch to him. I always thought Boyd had more in him than he was just able to show. I mean, I like his athletic ability, and I like his bulk. And he's a conscientious kid, and I think I'd like to see him come back and have a pretty decent career somewhere in the league here or elsewhere.
Now, this particular player was not active against the Seahawks, Bruce Gaston, but I'm wondering, do you think he starts to play a little bit of a role in this last game where Guion is suspended against the Chiefs?
Well, Gaston and Dayton Jones do the same thing, you know?
Agreed.
They're pass rushers, interior rushers first, so I'm not sure. I think as a D-line addendum, Mike, we need to mention that Kyrie Thornton is unemployed again.
Yes, he is. I saw that. I was going to ask you about him.
Yeah, the Patriots cut him, but then the Patriots, Belichick, signed him right back on the practice squad.
So, yeah, I mean, he's technically unemployed and could be added to a 53-man roster if necessary, but, I mean,
right.
he's at least, I guess, clinging by a little bit of a thread in New England.
Right. And let's face it, he's there each week. He's, what's that, $112,000 for the year, $6,000 or $8,000 a week? That ain't bad.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. I think it's 6,800 maybe, or 6,600,
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. And then before we shift off of the Seahawks game, you and I got an email the other day from a reader who wanted to know a little bit more about your explanation of, excuse me, your use of the term rope-a-dope as it applied in your film review when you were discussing James Jones, I believe. I mean, I've heard the term before, but I actually, when I read it, when I got the email, I went back and read the paragraph again, and I found myself wondering the same thing. What exactly do you use that term to mean?
So Ali and Foreman met in Kinshasa, Zaire in 74. And as I tell young people, Mike, and I'll mention it to you, and maybe any listeners who are under the age of 40, boxing, heavyweight boxing was the biggest thing going when I was a kid in the 60s and early 70s. And it was to the extent that at that Michigan Daily, where I'm going later today, I'd go to these closed-circuit broadcasts of the big fights and write a column based off that. I mean, people just – it was just – what everybody talked about was these fights. And so in that fight, Ali, you know, Foreman was considered to be unbeatable, indestructible, like a latter-day, early-day Mike Tyson. And Ali was getting older at that point, and so they fought in the jungle, and Ali just hung on the ropes and let Foreman punch himself out. And everybody thought Ali was nuts, he couldn't move, he was hurt, but he was smarter than anything. He just let Foreman punch himself out, and then in about the sixth or seventh, he opened up, and it was a TKO or a KO, I can't remember. And Ali described his tactic as rope-a-dope, just sitting there. And that's kind of what I see with James Jones. I mean, sometimes he just kind of comes off the line. He looks knock-kneed. He doesn't look good in a uniform, you know. He just kind of comes off a little bit. But, boy, when it's his time or whenever, man, this guy, he really springs into action just like Ali did.
And he was, I don't know if you saw his quote after the game, but he was within a whisper of having yet another touchdown reception on that play that was ultimately called out of bounds in the left side of the end zone. And I really liked his quote after the game. He said, you know, I guess we'll have to take that touchdown off the board for, and again, I'm paraphrasing here. We'll have to take that touchdown off the board because of our strength coach. He made me do so many squats, it built up my backside a little too much.
Funny.
Pretty good. James Jones is a good locker room guy. I enjoy his personality there. So let's see. We've covered the Seahawks now. Let's move forward to the Kansas City Chiefs. I know that you brought with you to Michigan your scouting report, and let's get the rundown.
First, Mike, I'm going to discuss. Oh no. Okay. Yeah. Let's get the rundown. Okay. Let's get the depth chart. Let's start talking about the Chiefs. Okay. Andy Reid calls the plays on offense, as he's done everywhere. Did it with the Eagles, and he's doing it in Kansas City. All right, their wide receivers, you know, they haven't scored a touchdown, Mike, since the playoff game in 2013. So they paid huge money for Jeremy Maclin to come from the Eagles. Maclin's a really good player, and he's a top 15 wideout in the league. Does it all. Not real big, that's the one thing. On the other side, they have basically nothing. Albert Wilson's just a small gadget. DeAnthony Thomas, ditto. You got Chris Conley, a raw, unbelievable athlete. Unreal testing numbers, but he's not quite ready. Jason Avant is the old possession crafty guy from the Eagles. Okay, so their number two target is the tight end, Travis Kelce, who can really run. He's big. He fell to the third round because of a lot of character issues at the University of Cincinnati. Dorsey and Reed took a chance, and he's been money for him so far. They took James O'Shaughnessy, a tight end from Illinois State, in the fifth round. Green Bay was extremely interested in that player. They took him. Green Bay took another receiver, the next one on the list, the Kennard Backman, around later in the sixth. Well, O'Shaughnessy, he looks good. He is a very fluid player. He's already had catches for 30 and 24. He does not look like a small school guy. His old teammate, Nate Palmer, will be involved with him. Demetrius Harris, UWM, UW-Milwaukee, basketball player. Everybody knows the UWM does not play football. They signed Harris off, you know, basically before, after that draft, and he, in his third year now, has blossomed as a heck of a blocker, much better than Kelce and O'Shaughnessy. He plays quite a bit in their run game. That's their receiving core.
Okay.
Any thoughts on any of that bunch, Mike?
Well, I guess one of the things that I've always sort of wondered, even with the signing of Jeremy Maclin, is how much the limitations of the quarterback in terms of his ability to throw consistently and accurately will limit the effectiveness of Maclin. And I assume we're going to move to Alex Smith coming up here.
Yeah. I mean, a lot. All right, let's go to Smith.
Yeah.
So Smith's a survivor, you know. And Dorsey Reed, they had no QB. Who'd they have? Quinn and Castle, I guess it was, at the end when they took over in January of 13. So they traded two twos to San Francisco for Alex Smith. He's, you know, he's had him in the playoffs. By and large, you'd have to say he did well. They paid him big money a year ago. He is a tremendously smart guy, 40 on the Wonderlic.
Yeah, that impressed me. That impressed me when I read your scouting report. 40 is not a common score.
We know how extremely intelligent Aaron Rodgers is. He had 35. Smith had 40. It's unreal. Smith was a tremendous athlete, and he still can take off and run. He's not a real accurate passer. He's not a great decision maker. He has improved, however, in both those areas. He's smart. When he brought the 49ers in 2011 and beat Green Bay in the opener, people around him, people buzzing him, went in the fetal position. He wasn't going to run around and fumble. Took a sack, played to his defense, played to his great punter. The guy's pretty solid. Now, you've seen him over time, Mike. Do you have any thoughts on Alex Smith?
Yeah, I guess he's just sort of one of those guys that you're waiting and waiting and waiting for him to put it all together in terms of combining the intelligence with, you know, the ability to make tough throws. And he does have the ability to make tough throws. It's just, he's kind of one of those guys that just makes weird choices at other points in time in the game. And I'm not saying he's on this level, because obviously this person that I'm about to mention makes some of the strangest decisions you'll ever see. But I think he has a touch of Jay Cutler in him in that respect, and that he can make the throws when he needs to. It's just there's other times where you're like, what in the world is going through that mind, especially for a guy who, as you just mentioned, is among, if not the smartest quarterback in the league. And I think the other impression that I've had about Alex Smith over the years is I think that, even maybe a little bit above what Aaron Rodgers does in terms of mobility, not pocket presence and ability to shift in the pocket, but I think Smith is an underrated athlete.
Oh yeah, right, no doubt. Okay, the running back, Jamaal Charles. His average is, what is it, 5.27?
Yeah, I believe it's among the best in NFL history, correct?
Number one, Mike. Yeah. Number one for guys with 1,000 carries. He's ahead of Jim Brown and Adrian Peterson. They're 2 and 3, and Barry Sanders is third or second on the list. I mean, Charles, he'd never played against Green Bay. He was injured for the game in 2011, and that's the only time they played since he arrived in 08.
Okay.
He ran 4.40 coming out. Opposing scouts and coaches this week described him as tough. He's not a very big man at 200, but he'll run inside. He's a flowing, graceful, great balance, jump cutter, subtle cuts in traffic, will lower the shoulder to fall forward. Breakaway, he's going to run away from almost every safety in the league. That builds that average, you know. But Barry Sanders cooked too, and Barry's not even that high. I mean, I don't know how to explain this. As a receiver, good. He can hurt you on wheel routes, broken plays, screens. They're a tremendous screen team. Checkdowns, he's a real threat. And then the backup is Niall Davis, who's ran like 4.38. He's a straight-line speed guy. Dorsey took him 3 years ago, and he's kept him as his number two back all 3 years. He can fly. The fullback is Anthony Sherman, who's a pretty good banger. Any thoughts on Charles?
He's so impressive when I watch him. You know, for a guy, I just remember seeing him when he played at Texas, and there were some games where, you know, for the first couple quarters, you know, he wouldn't do a whole lot. And then I remember at least two or three games where his fourth quarter production was off the charts, and he would just launch these incredibly long runs with all kinds of moves, whether it be the jump cuts that you mentioned. You know, we've seen him pull off spin moves before. And then that breakaway speed, which I think is so, I mean, you know it's there, but it's hard to anticipate, and it's hard for defensive players to say, I need to take a different angle on this guy because he's got those burners. It's hard in the course of the game to think that right away, but that's how he pulls away from guys, I think, is it's, you know, he's fast, but when you try and go and chase him down, it's even faster than you might have anticipated.
Yeah. We forgot to mention his fumbling.
Yes.
And the Packers certainly haven't forgotten, nor have the Chiefs and their fans. He fumbled twice against Denver, cost him the game in the last 30 seconds on a crazy fumble that they returned for a touchdown and beat him 31-24. His fumbles aren't extreme over time, but he's had enough of them that it's got to be a huge concern for the Chiefs.
I think so. I think it definitely does, especially when you've got a defense like the Packers have with players like Peppers and Matthews and, you know, players that are going to go for the ball because they're smart enough to know how to get the ball away from a running back.
To the offensive line, I did not see the Chiefs injury report, Mike. Do you know what Eric Fisher was, the right tackle?
Let me pull up the email. I have it here. I haven't looked at it since yesterday, so I'll have to take another quick peek here. Let's see. What do we got here? Injury report from Sarah Quick over at the Green Bay Packers. And it looks like, if this will open up for me. Here we go. Eric Fisher was a full participant.
Okay. Anybody, who were the limited or the outs yesterday?
None. All full participants.
Okay. All right, Fisher. It was a bad draft in 2013, and Dorsey and Reed really didn't have they had no full-fledged first pick. I think they tried to trade it. Nobody wanted it either. Everybody was too smart. So they took Eric Fisher over Jokel, the other tackle from Texas A&M. Neither one has really had much of a career so far. Fisher will start at right tackle. He's coming off, I believe, a high ankle sprain. He's only played a couple snaps all year. Ja Reed, the former Raven, was okay as a backup, but Fisher's the guy that has to come through for him, and he'll be starting at right tackle. The left tackle is Donald Stevenson, 17 starts in his career. Stevenson is a better athlete than not a real tough guy, a little soft, but he does have some athleticism, and he's not a total weak link. The center is new rookie Mitch Morse, a second-round pick from Missouri. Played tackle there. I really liked this guy before the draft. The Chiefs took him high. They took him in the second round. Morris is a tough guy, and he's 6'5 and a half, but he doesn't seem to have leverage problems. I think he's a good rookie, and he's played pretty good.
Okay.
They traded a fifth-round pick to the Saints for left guard Ben Grubbs. And Grubbs is okay. He's 31. He made the Pro Bowl selected once. He's more of an athlete. He still moves pretty well. He's fine. And then probably their worst starter right now is Laurent Duvernay-Tardif at right guard. He's a Canadian guy. A sixth-round pick in 2014 from McGill University. Tardif is a terrific athlete. He has long arms and great size. I mean, all that checks. But he's trying to kill people right now. He lunges a bit. He's not staying patient. I think he has a pretty good future. He's a real smart kid, but he's not playing real good right now. That's their offense, Mike.
Okay, fair enough. Let's shift over to the defense.
All right, on to the D. You got Mr. Sutton, who was actually a grad assistant at Michigan in 72 and 73 when I was over here, Mr. Sutton. Okay, he runs a 3-4, an aggressive form of it, and let's look at it. The front is probably their best defensive lineman is the 5 technique, Alan Bailey. You couldn't categorize him as a 5. He's a 3 or a 5. Bailey's a hard-charging guy. He's been a starter for about 4 years. Good player. I mean, not great, but a good player. On the left end, the run-plugger, classic 3-4 DE, is Mike DeVito. They got him from the Jets a couple years ago. He's got no rush, but he's really solid with his technique, stacking the run. He's a shock absorber, and he does a pretty good job at it. Inside, the two intriguing players.
Okay.
Now, they're starting Jay Howard, 96, over 92, down Terry Pope.
Okay.
And Howard is a guy who was a fourth round pick by Seattle out of Florida in 2012. He was cut in August of 2013 by the Seahawks, and he was lazy there, underachiever, didn't put out. He was the same way in Florida, but even in Florida, he got drafted in the fourth because he showed interior pass rush, that prized commodity. So Howard now against Denver last week, now they have kind of a weak interior of their line. He was a 12 on a 1 to 10 scale. Dominated the game like Raji did.
Okay.
Kicking butt, taking names. Mike, it was a man among boys. And I'm just telling you, he's 6'4", 320, and he played fantastic football. No idea. He wasn't like that in the opener. I have no idea if he can do that against Green Bay and Lindsley and good players, the guards. But on this night, he was a dominant player. Don Terry Poe is a tremendous nose tackle, one of the best in the business, 330, squat, fast, quick, nasty. He's coming off disc surgery in late to mid-July, and they're trying to limit his snap counts. He's still playing 40 to 50. So there's our, you know, four really solid D-linemen. All right, let's go to the linebackers. Justin Houston, the left outside backer, might be the best edge rusher in the game. 22 sacks last year. He's off to a great start. He's fast. He's strong. He's big. He's really learned the game. He's matured. This is a tremendous opponent for Don Barkley.
Okay.
He is what he is. He's great. Tom Mahali will be over on the other side against Bakhtiari. Ali's getting up there. He's in his 10th year.
He is.
Not what he was physically or athletically, but he is still a crafty, reckless, relentless guy. He can now and then beat you around the corner, but he's going to win more on strength. Still, on 1 to 10, he's a 7.5.
Really solid career he's had, too, hasn't it?
A lot of sacks, a lot of production. Team guy. Love the guy, yep.
Yeah, I agree.
Inside, you got on the weak inside, you got Derek Johnson. He will break the Chiefs' all-time career tackling record this week with 3 or 4, Gary Spanny's record. Johnson, he still can run. He's coming off a torn Achilles from a year ago. He's still fast. He will run through, take chances. He's smart. Don't ask him really to take on blocks. He will turn stuff down in the box. It's kind of strange to see, but I've seen it this season. He's not Mr. Physical, but he's still a good player, and he can really cover. The weak link in the front seven will be the Sam backer inside, Josh Mauga, just kind of a guy. Okay, now in the secondary. They're hurting because Sean Smith, their number one corner, is suspended for one more game, substance abuse. So their number one corner right now is Marcus Peters, the bad boy rookie at Washington, quit or thrown off that team out there last year. A lot of people hesitated and wouldn't touch him, but he's been a good kid out there so far, and he has played very, very good football. The grace, the fluidity, you see all that, plus he's loading a hit. The other corner is Philip Gaines, the nickel moves in there. He's on the thin side. He has good length. He's willing to at least try to tackle, but he should be. And then he moves inside to the slot, and he shouldn't be starting outside. In nickel, then, the number three corner, Jamel Fleming, who would be a four, he has to be the three. He's the weak link.
Okay.
Big Manning got all over him, gave up the winning touchdown pass. That's where the Packers will try to do business. The safeties, you got the best one is Ron Parker, who can really run mid-four threes. He's been cut, eight times in his first 3 years, but he's become a player. The other one is Eric Berry. He's coming off this lymphoma. It's a tremendous personal story of perseverance. Berry is not back to his previous self. He's still playing a little tentative, but he's fine. Former Viking Hussein Abdullah is a smart, cagey guy. He comes in like a dime safety. Plays a lot. Pretty good player. That's the D of Bob Sutton.
Okay.
Special teams, Dustin Colquitt is a very good directional punter. Santos is a good kicker inside 50. Winchester is the new snapper, replacing ex-Packer Thomas Gofford. DeAnthony Thomas is one of the great punt returners in the league. And Niall Davis has a lot of speed as a kickoff returner. Dave Tobe, the former coordinator of the Bears under Lovie Smith, when they had those great teams, he's in his third year as coordinator in Kansas City. He's outstanding. Those are the Chiefs.
I got a chance to see Cairo Santos play twice when I was in college. Syracuse had a home-and-home with Tulane. And you talked about how he's steady under 50 yards, and boy, is he automatic inside, 40, 45, 50 yards. He is as steady as they come, and I believe he was the number one, won the award, I forget the name of the award, but for the number one kicker in college football. He may have won it twice. I know he won it once, and just a really impressive kicker there. Obviously doesn't have the greatest range, but the accuracy is impressive.
Mike, the last time I saw?
I think so. Yeah, I saw either 6.5 or 7. Yep.
And McCarthy is 17-1 in his last 18 games as a touchdown favorite or more.
Okay.
He doesn't stumble much. I guess we should revisit 2011. I mean, it was a landmark game in Packer history. It certainly could have been. The last time the teams met, that was in December 18. 2011 at Arrowhead.
Okay.
The Chiefs had just fired their coach, Todd Haley, 6 days before. They were 5-8. They were about an 11, 12-point underdog. And they shocked the Packers 19-14. Green Bay was 13-0. Obviously no team had ever gone 19-0 and won the Super Bowl. Tremont Williams said after that game, obviously we wanted mention as the greatest team of all time. It was a stunning game, Mike. It was. The Packers needed three victories to break the all-time record for victories over two seasons. New England had won 21. So it was a stunning thing. Kyle Orton, who's out of football now, that's a player I couldn't believe the Cowboys didn't try to coax back into out of retirement this week. I would have done that in a heartbeat. But Orton played an unbelievable game under the coordinator, Bill Muir, who was 69 at the time, he ran the ball. They had 438 yards that day, 139 rushing. And they beat the Packers. There was nothing fluky about it, Mike. It was a complete shocker all the way. Rodgers that day completed 48.6% of his passes. He had six dropped, including three or four by Jermichael Finley. Mike McCarthy said, they pressed us from the time we got off the bus. Frankly, that's the way you stop a team that can throw the football. And I thought I'd mention this. I went back and I looked at that depth chart for the Chiefs, Mike.
Sure.
This is incredible. Of the 53 guys they had on their depth chart mid-December 2011, now that's less than 4 years ago.
Yep.
My guess would be that, okay, you got a new GM and a new coach, and that was a bad team, that there'd be like 12, 13, 14 holdovers, just guys on that 53. 53 on this 53.
And I guessed 11 when you asked me before we recorded this morning.
Mike, this is the NFL, fans. Five.
5 out of 53.
Zero on offense. An entirely new offense. It's like an expansion team. The only holdovers are the punter, Dustin Colquitt, and then four starters on defense. Justin Houston, Tom Mahali at outside backer, Derek Johnson at weak backer, and Alan Bailey, their good defensive lineman. So what does it tell you? It tells you you've got to be good to stay in the league. And the thing is just disposable. These players come and go.
And I think it also suggests to me as well that when you have a new GM and a new ownership group or whatever it may be, and there's a lot of new decisions being made, I think that the fact that they went from being a bad team to bringing in what amounts to 48 new players, and in 3.5 years, they're a decent team in the AFC, shows you how quickly things can turn around in this league as well.
Boy, does it ever. If you have a good GM and a good coach with a plan, yes, it is, Mike. You can do it. Yep.
Now, and while you were talking about some of the scouting report intricacies, I went back and I had it based on something you said about Jamaal Charles. You said, you can't really explain necessarily why this guy's yards per carry are so high. And I had just a hunch. And now there's a lot of things that go into this. This is by no means scientific. But I was wondering, because just as a casual observer of the NFL over the last few years, I sort of had thought maybe his touchdown runs were longer in general than some of the other guys. In other words, he was breaking longer runs that would have contributed to a higher average. So what do you make of these numbers? Jamaal Charles has 60 career touchdowns, and of those 60, 30% have been 30 or more yards. 30%, 33% actually, one-third exactly. Now compare that to Barry Sanders, who had just 24% of his rushing touchdowns of 30 yards or more. Compare that to Jim Brown, who had just 21% of his touchdowns 30 yards or more. So maybe Jamaal Charles has that ability to break some of these longer plays more consistently that end up skewing the average a little bit.
I think you answered our question, Michael. Fantastic. That's it right there, isn't it? That's it.
Yeah, Jim Brown has 126 touchdowns. He only had 27 of 30 or more yards. Jamaal Charles already has 20 touchdowns of 30 or more yards. Barry Sanders, 109 touchdowns, 26 of them were 30 yards or more. Again, Jamaal Charles already has 20 out of a career total of 60.
You know, I can picture Barry Sanders getting run down from behind. Yeah, and Jamaal Charles, maybe not that much if you saw him every day or twice a year or something,
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, that's it. Nice, Mike. Nice job.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I had to do something to contribute to this Bob McGinn Scouting Report show.
You're running this show, man.
All right, so is there anything else you want to mention about the Packers-Chiefs rivalry, or have we covered it?
The Chiefs have never won in Lambeau, if that means anything.
Yeah, Clay Matthews was asked about it yesterday, and he goes, BJ Raji, too, and they both said, I don't know the history of the rivalry with the Packers and the Chiefs. It's not the Bears.
I was talking on that story on the, I can't remember, like 2 weeks ago, I was talking to Craig Hendrick and BJ Raji, and we're talking about the history of the division. That
sure.
was it. And neither one of them knew that Tampa Bay was in this division for 25 years.
I wouldn't have known that either. You just informed me. I didn't know that.
From 77 to 01. Yeah, I guess I am old, and that proves that.
Yeah, but you're back in college. You're young this weekend, Bob.
Yeah, relive the glory days, eh, Mike?
Absolutely. So let's see, what's next on the agenda? Well, we had the injury to Josh Boyd, which opened up the roster spot for Joe Thomas. Were you surprised that they brought him back?
Somebody's got to go next week when Gian comes back. I was wondering if they might stay light for a week at 52. Somebody's got to go. I don't know. You talk to Thomas. What do you make of this?
Yeah, Thomas, boy, he was emotional in a good way in the locker room yesterday. The guy really, really thought that he deserved to be on the 53-man roster coming out of training camp. And in his defense, he did play very well, especially toward the last 2-3 weeks at camp. I was impressed with what I saw, and his reps with the first team received an uptick over the last half of training camp. He just sort of shared his crazy experience of what happened when he got the call and found out that he wasn't on the team. He said he was upset. Someone asked him if he threw out all of his Packer gear, and he said he was throwing things around his apartment because he was so frustrated, but he didn't throw away anything, didn't dispose of it, because he thought there was, you know, this was where he belonged. You know, call it crazy, call it a hunch, call it divine intervention, but it proved to be correct. And, he finds out on Saturday that he's not going to be part of the Packers 53-man roster or the practice squad. The very next day, he gets a phone call from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers offering him a tryout for their practice squad. So he says, okay, this is the next step. He packs up his belongings. He ships everything to Florida. He gets on an airplane, leaves Green Bay, has a layover in Chicago. And while he's in Chicago, he gets a call from the Dallas Cowboys, who offered him not a tryout for their practice squad, but a full spot on the practice squad, guaranteed. And he said, okay, I'll do it. So he went from Chicago to Dallas, and he said he lived in Texas without luggage for about a week because everything was in Florida. So he's back in the locker room yesterday. He's smiling. He's laughing. At one point, he got kind of choked up discussing what it means to him to finally be on a 53-man roster. And again, Bob, you know this guy. This is a guy who played FCS football and was by no means one of the strongest players coming out of school that season. He was an undrafted free agent. It's not like this guy was a freak. And all of a sudden, he's hanging on with the Packers by a thread, and now he gets a shot at the roster. It's a pretty cool story. And Joe Thomas is an interesting guy to talk to. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Thomas could figure in as a dime kind of a linebacker, Mike, if they can get him up to speed. You know, he has speed. Faster than Palmer or Jake Ryan. And right now they're using Clay Matthews as the 100% dime backer. And let's say they want to use Matthews as a rush guy, as an outside linebacker in the nickel and dime. You'd go to Palmer, you'd go to Ryan, maybe you go to Thomas, who's the fastest of the three. Now he's got he's a small school guy, he's got to know everything, but that could be a possible role for him down the road.
Yeah, I think Joe Thomas is a guy who will be able to contribute. I really do. And not only that, but he's a good special teams player, really plays with a lot of energy there. So we'll have to see what he can do, this week in practice, and whether or not he figures on the field Monday night is yet to be seen. But we've reached that point in the show where we take some of your questions. And the first question comes from some guy named Tyler Dunn. Have you ever heard of him? Yeah. Tyler Dunn wants to know, Bob, is the T.G. Shepherd ban still in effect for the podcast?
You mean the ban on T.G.?
That's what he said, the ban on T.G. Shepherd.
We don't like to go back, again, but I did it with Johnny Cash, so I think for a man that's great with T.G.'s unbelievable talent, I think we could go back to him. I do, Tyler. Thank you for asking.
thanks for chiming in, Tyler. I appreciate it. One that I know you've written about in the past, so this is one that I think you'll be able to answer here, from a guy named Jack Shearer. He says, do you guys have any thoughts on why Rodgers uses the hard count and free plays more, or at least more effectively, than other teams and quarterbacks in the league?
Well, one thing, Jack, young quarterbacks, they got so much on their mind, they don't even worry about the hard count. They just got a ton of stuff, reading defenses, formations, motions, and that's the last thing on their mind. I'm pretty sure that's one of the reasons. They're just not advanced enough to even worry about it.
And I think, go ahead, Bob. Sorry about that.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. And another thought I had is just that, Rodgers, and this is something that Clay Matthews said yesterday, he thinks that, Rodgers is just a step ahead in terms of mentally other quarterbacks in the league, that he's able to process things faster and quicker and more fluidly. So he just sees these opportunities that other guys, maybe they're perfectly competent quarterbacks, but they just don't see them or can't react to them the way that he does so instinctively.
Yeah. Another one would be, they get to the line so quick. McCarthy and now Tom Clements gets that play in fast, and when Rodgers gets up to that line or gets him a symbol out of the no huddle, there's 26 seconds left, and he has all day to do different things, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. We've got another question here from Paul Komorowski, who says who mentioned something that we talked about earlier when we talked about the package of Randall Cobb and Ty Montgomery being used out of the backfield. Paul wants to know, does the loss of Jordy Nelson reduce Randall Cobb's rush attempts out of the backfield?
I would say no. I just think Cobb's shoulder injury is the factor right now, but I think they'll hand it to him and play other people outside.
I agree. I think that right now they don't want him running the ball necessarily, so that because even when he's catching the ball, he can have a little bit more control. And again, the optimum word is little there because this is the game of football. But he's talked about how he can fall and try and fall the way he quote-unquote wants to protect that shoulder a little bit. And when he's got guys coming at him from all directions in close quarters around the line of scrimmage, if he's running the ball, that would be a little bit more difficult. Bob, you talked about Justin Houston and the challenges that he will present. So we have a question here that somebody wants to know. How much do you think they will help to slide over to – excuse me. Let me start again because I can't read. How much help do they slide over to Don Barkley? And will that lessen as he plays more, or does he need help throughout the season while he's on the field?
Well, in this game, let's stick with this game. I mean, yeah, they will try to slide Lang over there. But that's assuming Lindsley can go one-on-one against Jay Howard or Poe, which it's a problem because you got four good rushers here on this Kansas City thing. So there's going to be some chipping by a back, too. We'll see how Bakhtiari does against Ali. That's another, you know, potential breaking point. So it's a pretty good rush. There's, you know, people got to man up and do the job.
Yeah, and you got to remember, for as good as the interior line was of the Packers against the Seahawks with Sitton, Lindsley, and Lang, the two tackles did not have the greatest performances. And you might be able to argue that this rush this week is just as good, if not better, than the rushers that they faced last week in Seattle. All right, and the last question comes from Brendan Kennedy. Brendan says, Richard Rodgers seems like just a guy to me. He's copying your syntax there, Bob, just a guy. And then Brendan says, is there anything you've seen from Richard Rodgers that would convince you otherwise that he's not just a guy?
Well, he's never going to get any faster. So if that's what you call a JAG, well, then that's going to continue. But he can improve in a lot of areas. He has to improve as a blocker. And he has hands, and he can improve his route running, his knowledge of defenses. A lot of these things can help him improve his game.
I agree. I like Richard Rodgers' hands. I think he has above-average hands. He makes some really, really tough catches. Like you said, he's not going to get any faster. He's not going to necessarily get any more explosive. But I think there's ways for him to develop a little bit more. And I guess the way I kind of view it is, If I'm the Packers, I guess I'd rather have Rodgers on the field than Andrew Corliss, both because of, you know, his size, you know, his hands, and I think he plays with a little bit more nastiness than Corliss does.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mike, when you say NQO, no qualifying offer, JAG, just a guy, what are those acronyms?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, those would be acronyms. Yeah.
Okay. Here's another acronym for those who are. Would like to hear scouting lingo. NGE. You got a guess on what that means, Mike? If a player is an NGE?
That guy ain't good enough, Bob.
You got it. Not good enough, Mike. Good call. Yep.
I was trying to think really fast and see if I could work in some sort of serial reference just for you. But, yeah, we've exhausted our time here again. We've once again crossed the 50-minute threshold, and we can't believe any of you stay with us two lunatics that long. So thank you very much for listening to another episode of the Packers Podcast. Bob, you've got a full schedule ahead of you the rest of the day, don't you, my friend?
I'm going back into my past and then watch a victory over those Cougars of BYU.
Okay, so when Bob returns to Green Bay, he will be energized, refreshed, and we promise he won't be hungover.
My day to be a fan tomorrow, Mike.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys, and we will talk to you next week.